I've known Mish for probably more than half a century, I think. You'd be right, wouldn't it, Mish? And moved, both of us have moved, Mish more than me, and yesterday I had my three-year-old granddaughter staying overnight and said something about having people to lunch and a friend I'd known for a long time, and she said, "Is she very old?" And I said, "Do you think I'm very old?" And she said, "No." Consideringly, and I went, "Well, she's not very old either then." So because we're about the same age, slightly different. The other thing is, I thought I would say, because this is sort of really up right in front of my face, that you won't see me for a few weeks, in fact, for about 8 weeks. It's not because I've left the church, it's because I'm going on a ski trip. Now, everybody who knows me knows that I will not be going down a mountain on any kind of shape or form. It's called Spending the Kids' Inheritance, and I'm blessed and privileged to be able to visit friends overseas and go to the International Brethren Conference on Mission and also a Brethren History Conference. Yes, and catch up with various people, including people like the Millers and Stephanie Beach, who was Beach, who've been part of this fellowship, and Paul Quinn too. So let us look at this passage in Ephesians. I can safely say that at least some part of it applies to every single person here. Okay, who's been a child? Well, some people haven't been children, goodness. Okay, who's been a parent? Who's been an employer or a manager or a boss in any kind of situation? Who has been some kind of worker or employee? Thank you, David. Yeah, right. So, okay, there is something here for everybody. And in fact, when I reflected on this, I thought at some stage of my life, I have been in every one of those categories, and probably many of you that would apply to too. Now, these verses are not in a vacuum, and I'm going to do what previous speakers have done as well and point out that the previous chapters in Ephesians lead up to these verses about how we live. I think it's Jordan who said that the theology of those earlier chapters is linked to action. And I think it was Mike Wood who said that in chapter 2, where it talks about the cross abolishing the barriers and reconciling us to God, that it's both vertical, reconciling us to God, and horizontal, reconciling us to each other. Now, Ephesus was a church that Paul knew and where he had worked and where he was loved. You've only got to look at chapter 20 of Acts to see how everybody wept bitterly when they farewelled him because they realised they would never see him again. So he knew the makeup of this church. He knew that it was made up of parents and children and workers, employers, masters, slaves, and so on. And indeed, in the early church, we several times see in Acts where whole households converted to Christ. So the whole lot was very, it was not usual in the ancient world to have what we would call a nuclear family. It was far more usual to have a household where you had a father and a mother, possibly grandparent or other relation, children and slaves, maybe free servants, particularly in the better off families. But even not very well off families would have easily have one or more slaves. And it's only possible to do the things that are taught in these verses because of some of the previous things that Paul has said. And I'm going to just run over a few of these. There's heaps more I could have. It's only possible because we have redemption through God's grace in chapter 1. It's only possible because of his incomparably great power in us, chapter 1, verse 19. It's only possible because God has made us alive with Christ in chapter 2. Because we've been created in Christ Jesus for good works. It's only possible because he's able to do immeasurably more than we ask or think, it says at the end of chapter 3. And it's only possible because we forgive each other as God in Christ forgave us at the end of chapter 4. And in chapter 5, the emphasis where Paul talks about submitting to one another, having respect for one another. And the situation with this parent-child situation and the master-employer situation, the problem often arises when the whatever group you're in, you apply the instruction to the other group. It doesn't go down as well for a parent to say, you must obey me, right? It doesn't go down as well. It's much better where the parent goes, follows the instruction about not exasperating. And it's much better the other thing too for a master or an employer not to just say, you've got to do what I say, applying it to them, rather than looking at their own responsibilities. So bearing that in mind, let's look at these four categories: children, parents, employers, or slaves or servants, or employees and employers. Now, children, in fact, anybody who's over about seven theoretically should be listening to this. And I wish I'd known that there wasn't chaos, because I would have changed or incorporated things a bit differently, but a bit late to now. I think children clearly need to be of an age where they can actually make decisions and choices to listen to their parents. Obviously, tiny children, you are training them all the time, because it's a safety thing for a start. It's just safety to say, you need to do this when I say it. You don't run out on the road. You must hold my hand when I'm walking along, when we're walking along the street. It's safety for small children. But they, to meaningfully obey, they need to be of an age where they can take in what is said and make decisions about it. As I said, the children that Paul is talking to would clearly be part of a household and part of the church, that they're able to listen to this instruction. The contrast is, if you look at the home group notes, is that in the Roman and to some extent the Greek world of the time, a father was totally in charge of the household and could make decisions. And in fact, infanticide, killing babies, was a relatively common practice at different times. And we're talking about a situation where the gospel totally changed those relationships. We've got to take ourselves back to a time when we are so imbued with Christian teaching in this regard, and indeed all our the way that we in the Western world at least would bring up families is hugely influenced by Christian teaching. We need to think back before that and see how revolutionary this kind of teaching is. Now, what Paul says is, obey your parents, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Now, there's a number of ways that in the Lord could be mean. I think actually all of these meanings apply. It could mean that they are Christian parents, they're your parents, you're all in the Lord together. It could mean as if you were obeying the Lord, and that would actually fit with what he says to slaves later on. It could be because they're the parents that God has given you, or it could be do what they say as long as it does not conflict with something Christ tells you. So that's a number of angles, I suppose, for that word. And it is a commandment with a promise. It says, honour your father and mother, that it may go well with you, and so on. That's a promise in the Ten Commandments. I think honour means give them respect. You may not always agree as you grow older with everything that your parents say, but you need to honour at least their the position of care and responsibility that they're placed in with you, and the fact that they're funding your existence and so on, keeping you alive. And at least, and I'm thinking here of teenagers and young adults too, that's a time when you're forming your own opinions and making different decisions sometimes from what your parents would want. But you still need to do that respectfully. I'm not saying I was a role and total model with that. But also, I think as parents get older, I think there does need to be, with Christians, that there should be sort of a love and care relationship as far as it's possible, and some valuing, I wish my children were here to hear this, some valuing of their experience and opinion. That would be lovely, wouldn't it? Yes. I think sometimes my children might occasionally think that. But it's really easy for us to charge around. I think with shame of my own self, not exactly dismissing my parents' views, and I don't mean on Christian things, I mean on just life issues, but thinking that in general, you know, at 24 you know lots about life and you're fine, you don't really need to listen too much. And it's not that I ignored everything that was taught or anything like that, but I wish I'd been a little bit more gracious, I suppose. So this is children. It doesn't mean blind obedience, and it doesn't mean just, for instance, an example would be I have known of people whose parents, even Christian parents, very much opposed them going into full-time Christian work, and especially going overseas to do cross-cultural work. And that's been a very difficult decision, where their parents have said, you're going to leave us without support. You know, many others here probably know those kind of situations. That's one where you may respectfully differ. That's a sort of situation where you might respectfully differ with your parents and say, we really feel called by God to do that. So this is where I say, need to be to honour them, respect their opinions, but sometimes as adults we may need to differ. Okay, it says, fathers, do not exasperate your children and bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. And in Colossians, the parallel passage for this says, don't embitter your children, lest they be discouraged. Now, I take that to mean the unnecessary or unreasonable demands made on children, and particularly growing like teenagers. The unreasonable commands that lead to resentment and disobedience, and sometimes even dishonesty, where children are ordered to do certain things and they just, or don't do certain things and they do them behind their parents' back. And so it's a difficult tightrope to walk, where you want to protect your children, you want them to walk in God's ways, you are bringing them up in the training and instruction of the Lord, and yet you have to trust that they will actually do that, especially as they're getting towards late teens. So embittering them could be not trusting them. I give a personal example of my mother had been brought up in India as the children of missionaries. She'd gone to boarding school. She had quite a sheltered life in many ways, and she was quite apprehensive of what she saw of the 1960s in the paper, and, you know, the whole, believe me, this was not in our home at all, but, you know, she was really quite worried that her children would suddenly go on drugs and sleep with everybody. There was absolutely, believe me, absolutely, minus no evidence of this happening, and Michigan probably bear this out, who knew our family. But my mother's reaction to what she saw and what she'd heard from a couple of friends about their horrified going-ons at university and so on, that she was extremely protective, or we saw it as very protective, and to some extent I felt, well, it's probably factual to say she didn't trust us entirely, or particularly me. I was the eldest. You're as experiment on your eldest. And so I could have become, and at some stages did get quite bitter about this. I remember thinking, well, if she thinks I'm going to do that, why don't I just go and do it, you know? And I was sensible enough to go, no, that's not actually a good idea. That really isn't a good idea. I don't actually even want to do that she thinks I might. So fortunately, my father must have talked to her, I think, and said, you know, be a bit reasonable and so on. But yes, yeah, so make, the other thing is making impossibly high standards for your children. That can also exasperate and discourage them if the standards are so high that it's almost impossible to keep. Another one is continually nagging children. My children would probably say I'm an expert at that, so I better not talk too much about it. But it can discourage children. And also not recognising each child's potential and capabilities and having a mould for that every child should fit into. The risk. My parents were wonderful. I'm not trying to diss them totally, but my father was extremely bright and was a scientist and was really a polymath. He was good at languages and science and everything else, and couldn't see why all his brilliant children weren't like that. And spent half of my high school, most of my high school years, trying to tutor me in science and maths with sadly bad, no effect almost. And he couldn't, it took a long time before he would concede that my strengths were in history and languages, and believe me, absolutely not in science or maths. And he was not trying to force me into that mould. It was, I recognised that it was concern and love that made him keep encouraging me to do well in those subjects. But it took a while before he actually gave in and recognised that. So all those kind of situations are things where people can, children can get embittered or exasperated. And indeed, at some point in my authorised version of the Bible that I was using in my teens, both this verse and the one in Colossians have been underlined so hard it nearly went through the page, where I was probably wishing that applied, wishing that Dad would read it, and he didn't. Well, but on the other hand, more positively, again, with my parents, my father was wonderful at spending time with us. And they were also very good at explaining and reasoning about why they made certain decisions that affected us. And that meant we were less likely to rebel, and we didn't, in fact. We had great affection and respect for them. They were also completely consistent role models for us. We saw them reading the Bible in quiet times. Knew that their total priority was the fellowship of God in the small church in which we were involved, that being involved in that church was absolutely integral to their lives, and it was just so obvious that it wasn't, that's how life was. God was the most important person in life. And another thing about not exasperating your children. My father-in-law said once, many years ago, he said, we always tried to say yes instead of no, if it was at all possible or reasonable. This is to teenagers. So the sort of thing where you say, oh, can we go out for, yeah, even in those days, coffee after the service at night, and your instinct is to go, oh, no, you've got school tomorrow. And he said, we tried to think, well, it wouldn't hurt for once, that kind of, you know, yes, so long as you're home by 10 or something. So you might temper it, but try to not automatically say no if yes was a possibility. I often thought of that. Okay, so it's a mutual thing, fathers and mothers and their children. Right, on to slaves and servants. It's respect again. Obey your earthly masters with respect and fear and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. And I'm not going to talk about the whole system of slavery. It underpinned the Roman Empire society. There were something like 60 million slaves across the empire. It was not possible to suddenly free them all. And if Paul had come up against that head on, it would have been absolutely disastrous, I suppose, for spreading the Christian faith. And in many ways, he did not need to do that, because this teaching of slaves and masters undermines the whole thing. If the slaves and masters obeyed these verses in Christian households, basically slavery kind of doesn't exist in that household. You'll see that also with Paul's letter to Philemon. I've spoken on this before. If you acted like this, the whole master, slave, the ownership concept is wiped, basically. And whether or not they're actually free, and many slaves were freed by their masters, especially in wills and just before they died and so on, whether or not you're actually free in essence, in spirit, you were. And so both masters and servants are reminded that Christ is their master. Both of them, both classes have Christ as their master, and they're both to serve or to be a master as though Christ is in charge. And the same idea is expressed in Colossians 4. Now, we might not be slaves, although sometimes people refer to wage slaves, don't we? No. And sometimes we're in jobs we're not that wrapped about. We stay in because we need the money. But the same principles apply. Respect managers. Work consistently, even when we're not being watched. Work properly. Work wholeheartedly, as if the Lord had asked us to do it. And I often think about that. There used to be a poem, I could have looked it up, about doing the washing up as though Jesus was watching you. I often think about that when you're doing a lot of washing up when your children are small, or the washing for that matter. Also, honesty and transparency. Obey them not only when their eye is on you, but like slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from your heart. And the reason is because you know that the Lord will reward everyone for whatever good he does, whether you're slave or free. It's the Lord who will reward you. It's not your master or somebody else. And these apply to anybody who's employed in any kind of way, including self-employed. And they tie in, the things he's saying here tie in with that list of attributes in Romans 12. I'm going to skim through some of these. Love must be sincere. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Honour one another. Be joyful in hope. Patient in affliction. Lots of slaves must have had to be that. Share with God's people. Bless those who persecute you. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right. Live at peace with everyone, if at all possible, etc. Those things are the same principles, and it's talking to a church, but it's the same for households. And masters or employers. Now, in our case, that would be employers or our manager, line managers at work, or something like that. We should be non-threatening, since don't threaten them, because, again, your master is in heaven. So this is talking to Christian employers, but that's, if any of us are employers, that's who we are. Not domineering, not unreasonable, so, and no favouritism. I think many of us have probably worked in workplaces where favouritism was a problem. So I've got two examples I want to bring here. One's a bad one, one's a good one. So the bad one is that many years ago when I was teaching, I asked one of the grade 10 kids, would he like to do some work over the holidays for my husband and me in the garden? I'd successfully done that with a couple of other students, been a good way for them to earn a bit of money. And I'd always checked what the going rate should be for that sort of thing. And this young man, I'd got to know his family a bit, so I felt quite free to sort of ask him. And he said, no thanks, Mrs. Willie, no offence, but Christians always rip you off. Now, how did he know that at 15 or 16? I was horrified. I was utterly horrified. Christians always rip you off. It's rung in my ears for 45 years. Is that not a terrible, terrible reputation? I don't know where he got it from. He wouldn't tell me. Got the idea? I hope it rings in your ears if you're ever in the position to employ somebody. Christians always rip you off. And I said to him, I've got no intention of ripping you off, of course, and said that I'd done something like ring the Department of Labour and Industry and said, how much do you pay 16-year-olds? And they couldn't tell me. They didn't have anything. So I'd done my best to be fair, and I'd asked around and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, he wouldn't work for me, even though we had a really good relationship. So, unfortunately, the love of money, as Paul says elsewhere, is the root of all evil. and employers over the ages have sometimes made making money more important than treating their employees well, and that includes Christian, so-called Christian employers. The opposite, a much more positive example I'd like to leave with you, is the Cadbury brothers. Okay, who's ever eaten a Cadbury chocolate? Some people haven't. Okay, wow. The Cadbury brothers had their firm, inherited a firm from their father in Birmingham. They built it up towards the end of the 19th century. They were Quakers. They were committed Christians. They were absolutely committed to applying their faith to their workplace. And they, as soon as they could afford it, they bought a new property on the edge of Birmingham in the country, a large amount of land. They put up a modern building. They believed that it was better for employees to have fresh air and good working conditions, because they believed that they would actually work better, and that it was right, that it was right that people not live in bad conditions and not be working in horrible, you know, factories and so on. They put up a modern building that included a tennis court and pools. I think the pools were for both female and male, separate. They had education classes. They had schemes for promoting people. They were the first firm, it says on the website I found, to introduce a Saturday half day, because in those days people worked 6 days, and Cadbury introduced 5.5. And I believe in Tasmania they might have been the first to have a 9-day fortnight. My uncle worked there in the 50s and 60s. They had country outings and summer camps. They had morning prayer and Bible reading for 50 years until the factory got so big it wasn't really feasible to put everybody into that. And they were housing reformers as well. All of this from a Christian perspective. They believed that people should be well housed. They built houses and then sold them at a reasonable rate to workers. They particularly had houses like the Cadbury Estate out at Claremont for their managers, but they also in England had these other ones. And George Cadbury set up, rather than give his children, his numerous children, a, you know, super leg up in life, partly with their agreement, he set up the Bourneville Trust and put most of the money into that. And they basically earned their own way in life with a little bit of help. Huge amounts of good were done by that, following this kind of teaching and all other Christian teaching about how we should treat people. So it's a great story. There's actually, not long ago, I read a book about it, which alerted me to this. And it's an example. I know they had lots of money, but it's an example of what can be done. And so these are seemingly simple commands. Children obey, fathers don't exasperate it, slaves obey, masters treat your slaves well. But they're quite difficult to do. And they're only possible because of those verses I read first, that we have been redeemed and made alive and created for good works, and God gives us his power to do that. And it shows that in our everyday lives, the beautiful things we have been singing about this morning apply to all our actions every day, that we honour Christ and show that we love and follow him in all our everyday actions at home and at work. Thank you.